I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is New York Times columnist and PBS NewsHour commentator David Brooks, whose new book is The Road to Character.
Hello and good evening. I'm Warren Browner, the chair of the board here at the JCC in San Francisco. And on behalf of everyone here at the JCC, I'd like to welcome you to this evening's Arts and Ideas program with David Brooks, the esteemed columnist for the New York Times, a political and cultural commentator, and best-selling author. He's been a senior editor at the Weekly Standard, a contributing editor at Newsweek and the Atlantic Monthly, and I'm sure you all know him as the weekly commentator on the NewsHour, part of my Friday afternoon enjoyment. He's also a frequent analyst on NPR's All Things Considered. His books include Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, and The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David Brooks explores the importance of humility and virtue in his new book, The Road to Character. Depth, he argues, is something that is cultivated over time through commitments we make to a nation, a faith, a calling, or loved ones, and the sacrifices we endure because of making those commitments. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Brooks to Canbar Hall.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here in San Francisco and at the JCC. Jews and from San Francisco, obviously a lot of Republicans in the room. My natural base. Having spent a lot of time around Jews and around San Franciscans, I should be brief. I know you didn't come here to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak. And so I'll try to get out of the way of that. I should say that even though I do come more from the center-right part of the platform, I do have a lot of in common with people in this particular demographic, assuming that you are mostly on the left. I started out on the left. I lived in Greenwich Village in New York City, and my parents were professors in the 60s, and they took me to a bee-in in Central Park in 1965, which was a place where hippies would go to bee. And one of the things they did was they set their a garbage can on fire and threw their wallets into it and to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I saw a $5 bill on fire in the garbage can, and I reached into the fire and ran away with the money. That was my first step over to the right. Then my life took other little turns, twists and turns. They sent me to a place called Grace Church School. I was part of the all-Jewish boys davening choir at Grace. We would sing the hymns, but we wouldn't sing the word Jesus to square it with our religion, so the volume would drop down and then would come back up. And then I knew early on at age 7 I wanted to be a writer. I read something called Paddington the Bear, who some of you have read, and I decided I was going to do that. I remember in high school I wanted to date a woman named Bernice, and she didn't want to date me. And I remember thinking she dated some other guy, and I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. So she had those values. And then, like a lot of people in this room, I went off to the University of Chicago, where fun goes to die. I think that's an obsolete. The better slogan about Chicago is it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. Absolutely different. And then life took other turns. I had become reasonably secular. I married my then wife, and she was Protestant when we were married. 3 years into the marriage, she decided she wants to convert to Judaism. Then she decides she wants to become the mikveh lady at the synagogue. She wants to keep a kosher home. She wants to study for the rabbinate. She wants to send her kids to Jewish day school. And so this was all a shock to me, and I decided that God must exist because only he would go so far of his way to screw me this badly to stay. And so we led a more Jewish life than I anticipated. Spent a lot of time in Israel. I've probably been there 19 or 20 times for work or for pleasure. My favorite story about Israel, I was driving in Tel Aviv about 4 years ago, and there was a bus turning a corner. They honked at me to back up. And so I backed up, and I backed right into the car of the young, hip Israeli guy behind me. And he got out of the car, but he didn't scream at me. He ran right past me and started screaming at the bus driver. And then he came back and gave me a hug because we were brothers in the war against bus drivers. And then some other bus driver pulled out, totally unrelated. He broke from me and started screaming at that guy. And that's what I like about Israelis. They don't understand the distinction between public and private life. They just embrace you with a fervor that is sometimes exhausting but sometimes charming. I had a friend who, years ago when you used directory assistance, called to get directory assistance for a specific restaurant in Jerusalem called Ocean. And the operator, he said, you know, do you have the number for Ocean, the restaurant? And the operator said, nah, you don't want to eat there. That is Israel. And so you have these twists and turns. Most unexpected for me, my son now serves in the IDF. And so that's something I didn't expect. But life has these twists and turns. And so my life has had various twists and turns, most of them phenomenally good. And sometimes it's the good ones that have produced the biggest changes. It's been about 12 years now. I was driving home. I do a segment on PBS on the NewsHour called Shields and Brooks with Mark Shields. We wanted to call it Brooks Shields. We thought that would have gone over better. But it was the summertime, and I get out at 7 p.m., and it was still light out. And I drove home, and I got home about 7:20, and I pulled into my house. And the driveway in a place called Bethesda, Maryland, went around the side of the house, and I could see in the backyard. And my kids were out there playing, and they had a little ball you get in the supermarket, and they were kicking it up in the air, and then it was arcing and curving in the wind, and then they were running across the yard and trying to be the first one to get to it, and they were tumbling all over each other and laughing. And the summer evening sun was coming through the trees, and the grass was green, and I just was surprised by this tableau of the kids running across the yard and laughing and piling on top of each other. And I just stared at them through the windshield for a few minutes. And it's one of those unexpected moments when life and time are suspended and when reality sort of spills outside its boundaries and you get a sense of feeling of overwhelmed with gratitude. That what have I done to deserve this? And you have that sense of getting more than you deserved, which elicits a sort of strange stirring. And first you're experiencing higher joy, which is better than anything else you experience at work. Second, it exposes your depth because your heart sort of suddenly comes alive. And third, you get the sense that you want to be worthy of such moments. And this happened at that time. I remember it sometimes happens to me when I'm around people who radiate an inner light, that they generate this thing that you want to be worthy of. You'd like to be like that. A couple months ago, I was lucky enough to be seated next to the Dalai Lama at a luncheon in Washington. And he's a guy who laughs at random moments. And so I'm sitting next to him, and he just starts laughing randomly. And you want to be polite, so you laugh back. And then he laughs, and you laugh. And you feel like you should say a joke in the middle just to sort of rationalize the laughter. And I remember once I was feeling awkward, so he has a little Dalai Lama bag, a little canvas bag. And I said, so you got any candy in there? And so he starts pulling out stuff from his Dalai Lama bag. And it's basically everything you get in the first class cabin of an international flight. And so it's like the little the eye get shades, the earplugs, a little razor, a little toothbrush. And then he pulls out a Toblerone bar. And so he did have candy in there. But he radiated that inner light. And he's a global celebrity. But, I'm sure all of you have had this experience. About once a month I run into somebody who just radiates a joy. I was in Frederick, Maryland with some ladies who teach immigrants English and then how to read it. And it can take years to do this for adult immigrants. And there were about 35 ladies there, age 50 to 75, I'd say. And they came in and they were just joyful to be around each other. And they rated a love and a patience, and their laughter, I remember, was musical. And when you talked to them, they seemed calm. They made you feel really important. And they weren't thinking about what good work they were doing. They weren't thinking about themselves at all. And that, too, was a sort of inner light. And my reaction was that I've achieved way more career success than I ever thought I would, but I haven't achieved that. That what they have, that inner light, or what the Dalai Lama has, is something that you don't get by writing for the New York Times, God knows. And so I remember thinking, well, you only get one life. I want to spend part of it trying to be like that. Now, I'm obviously in a profession that mitigates against that. I'm a pundit. I'm sort of paid to be a narcissistic blowhard. But I spent a few years trying to think about what do they have and how do they get that. And I came to the realization there are two sets of virtues, what you might call the eulogy virtues and the resume virtues. And the resume virtues are the things you bring to the marketplace, what make you good as a journalist or a doctor or a professor or a lawyer. I've hit the Jewish trifecta there. And then there are the eulogy virtues, which are the things they say about you after you're dead. Whether you're courageous, honorable, brave, whether you're capable of great love, the quality of your relationships. And we all know the eulogy virtues are more important than the resume virtues. We'd all rather have those. But we live in an educational system, an meritocratic culture that is a lot clearer on the resume. And the educational system teaches students a lot more about skills than how to build a good character. And a lot of us are more articulate about how to build a career than how to build character. And somebody helped me understand this was Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, a great rabbi who wrote a fantastic book in 1965 called The Lonely Man of Faith. And Soloveitchik argued that there are two sides of our nature, which he called Adam 1 and Adam 2. And Adam 1 is essentially the resume Adam, the external Adam, career-oriented, ambitious, wants to build, create, produce, and discover things. Very honorable side of our nature. But the second is what he called Adam 2, the humble Adam, which is the internal side. Adam, too, wants to embody certain moral qualities, wants to have a strong inner character that honors creation and one's own possibilities, wants to have a solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good. And so while Adam, 1, wants to conquer the world, Adam, 2, wants to obey a calling and serve the world. Adam, 1, asks how things work. Adam, 2, asks why things exist and what ultimately we're here for. Adam 1 wants to venture forth. Adam 2 wants to be anchored. And so the tough part about these two Adams, Soloveitchik says, is that they are in confrontation with each other. Sometimes having a great inner character helps your career. Sometimes you have to trade off. I have a friend who interviews a lot of people for a company he works for. He's the HR guy. And I say, what question do you ask people in the job interview process? And he always says, I asked him the following: name a time you told the truth and it hurt you. And he's basically asking for Adam 2. And the hard part of the confrontation is the Adams live by different logics. The external Adam lives by an economic logic, which is straightforward, which is, practice makes perfect, input leads to output, effort leads to reward. It's economic. Adam 2 lives by a moral logic, which is often inverse and paradoxical. You have to give to receive. You have to surrender something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success can lead to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure can lead to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. Now, as I say, we live in a culture that nurtures Adam 1, the resume side. We live in a society that's competitive. You've got to spend a lot of time thinking about your career to prosper, to get in the right college, get the right job. We live with fast and shallow communications that can drown out the still soft voice in the depth. We live in a culture of a big me that says you're wonderful. We train our kids to think they're wonderful. The commencement cliches tell us we have a little golden figure inside which can be trusted. Follow your passion, be true to yourself, trust yourself. And we've told a generation, really a couple generations, including my own, how great they are. and they believed us. And so in 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? And in 1950, 12% said yes. They asked the same question again in 2005, and it wasn't 12% who said they were very important, it was 80%. Scientists have a thing called the narcissism test, the psychologists do, where they say, well, I'm going to read you a bunch of statements. Does this apply to you? And there are statements like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary. Somebody should write a biography about me. I like to look at my body. And the median narcissism score has risen 30% in the last 20 years. They give these tests all around the world, and the U.S. is number one in narcissism, followed by Serbia and Israel. Along with these tests, this increase in self has gone an incredible increase in desire for fame. UCLA does these. They ask college freshmen, what do you want out of life? And for about 40 years, the number one answer was, I'd like to have a meaningful philosophy of life. That answer, which used to be the number one answer year after year, is now the bottom answer. Financial security is the number one now. But second or third is fame. People want to be famous. One group of psychologists asked junior high school girls if they'd rather be a celebrity's personal assistant, Justin Bieber's personal assistant, or president of Harvard. And of course, by 3-1, they'd rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. Though to be fair, I asked the president of Harvard, and she would rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. College students were asked, would you rather have a life that involves a lot of fame or that involves a lot of sex? And by 2-1, they'd rather have the life that involves fame. And so I go to college campuses and I say, you know, I'm on TV twice a week. I have a column in a prominent paper. I'm kind of famous. Go with the sex. It's better. But they don't believe me. And so we haven't created a culture of bad people. College students are amazing. But we've created a culture that's a little morally inarticulate. Christian Smith is a sociologist from Notre Dame who went around college campuses and asked, can you name your last moral dilemma? And 70% could not name a moral dilemma. So they'd say, you know, I pulled into a parking space. I didn't have any quarters. I wanted to rent an apartment. I couldn't afford it. He would say, you know, that's sort of a problem. It's not really a moral dilemma. And they just hadn't been given the vocabulary to describe moral dilemmas. And generally, our vocabulary has changed. It used to be we used Google Ngrams to measure the usage of words. And economic words in newspapers, magazines, and books are used more and more frequently. Moral words are used less frequently. The word bravery over the last 40 years, usage is down 66%, gratitude down 49%, humbleness down 52%, kindness down 56%. We're just talking about this stuff less. And so I found in my own life that if you focus on the resume, the Adam 1, and sort of let the other stuff slide, you turn into sort of a shrewd animal. You live with an unconscious boredom, not really attached to high ideals. You settle for a sort of moral mediocrity. You grade yourself on a forgiving curve. You think, people seem to like me. I don't seem to be obviously hurting anybody. But over time, you're slowly turning a core piece of yourself into something less impressive than you'd hoped. There's a humiliating gap that opens up between your desired self and your actual self. You don't deserve the sort of eulogy you want, and you don't have that inner light. And so I spent a few years trying to figure out how do people get that? Not to be good on the outside, but how are they really deep and good on the inside? And so I went around thinking, you know, abstract philosophy is not going to do it. We're mostly influenced by each other, by people. Which people have done it, and how does it look? And so I gathered in the book a group of like 10 friends, 10 prominent people who had great careers, and I'm not against that, but they also had great inner lives, and they weren't born that way. At age 20, they were sometimes very pathetic, but by age 70, they were magnificent, and I want to know how they did that. And one of them was famous Dwight Eisenhower. When Eisenhower was 9, he wanted to go out trick-or-treating, and his mom, this remarkable woman named Ida, wouldn't let him. And so Ike threw a temper tantrum, and he punched the tree in the front yard, and he punched it so bad he rubbed all the skin off his knuckles. And Ida sent him up to his room, had him cry for an hour, and then went up an hour later and bound his wounds and recited a verse from Proverbs, which is that he who conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city. And 60 years later, when Eisenhower wrote his memoirs, he said that was the most important conversation of his life because it taught him that he had a problem, which was his temper, and that he had to beat it. And he did beat it over the course of his life. We think of him as this garrulous country club kind of guy, but in fact, inside, he was roiling with anger and hatred. During World War II, he would, and during his presidency, he would be up nights lying awake, insomnia, anxiety attacks, drinking, smoking, throat infections, spiking blood pressure. But he knew he couldn't succeed as a leader if he acted that way. So he constructed an artificial, cheerful, optimistic persona, which he then carried forth into public life. Some of his techniques to defeat his own temper were silly almost. He was a big hater, so he'd write the names of people he hated on pieces of paper and then rip them up and throw them into the garbage cans as a way to purge. And so what we learn from him is the power of self-defeat. First, the power of humility. Humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. It's radical self-awareness from a distance. It's being able to see yourself and see your own weaknesses. And Eisenhower was able to do that thanks to his mother. And then to contend with his weaknesses, to confront them, and really spend his life confronting them. Thomas Merton wrote, "Souls are like athletes. They need opponents worthy of them if they are to be tried and extended to the full use of their power." And Eisenhower did extend himself by confronting his own temper, his own passion, and then really overcoming it. And he achieved a serenity by the end of his life. The second person who teaches a lesson is Samuel Johnson, the great essayist. He was born in 1709 in England. He barely survived the ordeal of his birth. He was handed over to a wet nurse whose milk infected him with tuberculosis, rendering him blind in one eye and deaf in one ear. He developed smallpox, which left him scarred. They performed surgery on his jaw, which left a gouge. They opened his arm to bleed him, and they left the wound open for 6 years. He soon developed what we now think was Tourette's syndrome and OCD. He couldn't control his own body. It was very hard to eat with him because he was just spewing food. He went to Oxford, where he failed as a student after a year. He became a teacher and failed there. By age 30, he had lived a life, as he wrote, radically wretched. And so he suffered. Now, suffering is to be avoided and not to be celebrated, but some people are able to turn suffering into something good, moments of suffering that we all confront. And so Paul Tillich, the theologian, wrote that what suffering does is it takes you below the everyday aspects of life and reminds you you're not who you thought you were. Tillich wrote that suffering carves into what you thought was the basement of your soul and carves through the floor and reveals a cavity below, and then carves through that and reveals a cavity below. And so in these periods of suffering, really in his 20s, Johnson had his illusions of self-mastery shattered. But he also was introduced to himself. And he became capable of radical self-honesty. And so he wanted to turn that suffering into something good. Nobody ever says, you know, I have two friends who lost a child at age 6. And they don't say, you know, we lost our son Henry. We should go out and party to balance up our hedonic account. They want to take Henry's death and their grief, and they want to turn it into something holy. And so they created a foundation, Hope for Henry, to try to make his suffering into something good. And so Johnson had both that intense moral aspiration combined with radical self-honesty. And so he goes to London at age 30, and he just starts writing. And he really writes his way from disorder to order. He can't control his mind, he can't control his body, but he can control his understanding of the truth, and he anchors himself to the reality of the truth he sees. He develops this tremendous love of wisdom, tremendous curiosity, told that a certain river in Oxford was hazardous and people were drowning there, he jumped into that river to know what it was like. Told that if you put two musket balls into a gun and shot it, it would explode, he put seven balls into the gun and shot it against the wall. He wrote about all the things he suffered from. So he wrote these moralistic essays on sloth, which he was lazy, on envy, on guilt, on boredom, on sorrow. And he slowly made himself into a very solid individual with a settled philosophy of life. One biographer wrote that by middle age, the iron had entered his soul, and he approached questions of human conduct in the light of a terrible experience, which enabled him to penetrate into human motives with sureness and understanding. By middle age, he was capable of great acts of industry. It took the French Academy 40 scholars and 50 years to write the first French dictionary. It took Johnson alone with six clerks 8 years to write the first English dictionary. Between age 68 and 72, he wrote 52 small biographies covering 378,000 words. Awesome amount of writing at any age. Then he started giving away his writing. He had a friend who got a lectureship of law at Oxford called the Blackstone Lectureship. Unfortunately, his friend didn't know any law. So Johnson said, I'll write you the lectures just for free. So he wrote 60 lectures stretching over 1,600 pages of text for free. He was a member of a social club, a great social club with Adam Smith and Joshua Reynolds and Edmund Burke. But at home, he gathered stray people who had nowhere else to go. His home usually had 10 or 13 people in it, former prostitutes, former slaves, people with no money, a doctor who had served the poor. And by the end of his life, he's become this incredibly impressive person through active intellectual power. When he died, a colleague wrote, he has made a chasm which not only nothing can fill up, but which nothing has a tendency to fill up. Johnson is dead. Let us go with the next best. There is nobody, no man can be said to put you in the mind of Johnson. So if Eisenhower is self-defeat, Johnson is the voracious hunger for intellectual philosophy, of settled philosophy of life. And these two things are part of what leads people to depth. The third person is a woman named Frances Perkins, who was the first secretary, the first female in an American cabinet. She was Secretary of Labor under FDR. She was a young woman. She went to Mount Holyoke, one of those colleges that leaves a mark. Holyoke had rules then that are different than the rules in most American colleges. For example, here's Mount Holyoke, class of 1902, some of the rules that applied to the students. Freshmen should keep a respectful silence in the presence of sophomores. Freshmen meeting a sophomore on the campus shall bow respectfully. No freshman shall wear a long skirt or hair high on head before the mid-year examinations. So they're teaching deference. Perkins's worst subject was chemistry, so they forced her to major in chemistry. They figured if you can beat your weakest subject, you can beat anything. But what Holyoke did was they gave the women there this heroic aspiration. The phrase was, go where no one wants to go, do what no one wants to do. So they sent single women, 1902, all around the world to do missionary work. Tibet, Nepal, Pakistan, Africa, they're all over the world. Somebody did a survey of the female missionaries abroad in like 1920, and 25% were Holyoke grads. They just had this earnest effort and courageousness. Perkins didn't go abroad. She went to Chicago, worked at a place called Hull House with Jane Addams, and then came back to New York. And in 1913, she's having tea around Washington Square, if you know that area. And she hears a commotion. She and her tea companions rush out in the square, and they see a fire. And they've stumbled across one of the most famous fires in American history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. And she thinks she sees people hurling bundles of clothing out the 10th floor window. But it's like 9/11. People decide to leap to their deaths as opposed to being burned to death. And she sees 53 people go over the edge. She sees a guy hoisting a lady over the windowsill and dropping her into space, and a second, then a third. The fourth is his girlfriend. They kiss. He drops her, and then he goes. And that was a pivotal moment in her life. She was already sort of an activist, but that was what you might call a call within the call, the moment when she purifies her activism. She quiets herself. It's not about the money anymore. It's not about security. It's not even about gentility. It's about doing whatever needs doing to advance the cause of worker safety. She'll compromise in any way to move it forward. She'll work with anybody, no matter how sleazy. And she turns herself from that moment and for the rest of her life into an instrument for a cause. And she goes to Albany. She becomes an activist and a lobbyist trying to get legislation passed. But she discovers the guys, the Tammany Hall politicians, won't take her seriously because she's a young woman. And so she keeps a folder at home called Notes on the Male Mind. And she says, they won't take me seriously as a young woman, but they all want to be loved by their mothers. So she dresses like an 80-year-old woman and gets the nickname Mama Perkins. She wears gray pearls, frumpy gray dress, old-fashioned hairstyle, tri-corner hat, and she becomes an amazing lobbyist and passes amazing legislation, then goes works for Governor Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt, and then for FDR, Secretary of Labor. And from her, we learn the power of vocation. And she doesn't, you know, today we tell college students, find your passion. But 80% of college students don't have a passion. Today we tell college students to look inside themselves. But Perkins did not find her vocation by looking inside herself. She found it by looking out in the world and see what problem needed healing. I'm sure a lot of people in this room have read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Frankl was a psychologist in Austria. The Nazis put him in a concentration camp. And he said, well, this really wasn't what I was asking of life. But this is what a life asked of me. And so he said, I'm gonna study pain and suffering. I'm going to see what I can learn. He wrote, pain became a problem upon which I did not want to turn my back. And he decided that the way to find meaning in life is not to ask what you want, but what is it expecting of you? What are your circumstances expecting you to do? Where does your deep gladness meet a world's deepest need? And Frankl would sit around with the people who are contemplating suicide in the camps and say, life has not stopped expecting things of you. You can't do that. And he went around teaching for the rest of his life on that philosophy. And so from Perkins, we learn the power of vocation, not just a job, but a calling. And we would say people of great depth have that. The fourth person I'll mention is the great novelist George Eliot. Eliot was born to a mother who was very ill and really could not provide her with love. And so Eliot grew up emotionally needy. She could be counted on to create a hysterical, go into fits of hysterical crying if she was not the center of attention. As a young woman, she fell in love with every guy she came across. Young, old, tall, short, married, unmarried. She'd fall for them all. She'd entrance them with her conversation, which was impressive, and then their wives would kick her out of the house. That was the normal pattern. By age 32, she fell in love with a philosopher, Herbert Spencer, who was her intellectual equal. And at age 32, she wrote him a letter that was at once pathetic but also impressive. The pathetic part was in the beginning where she's begging him to marry her. It's like, please marry me, please. You won't even notice me around the house. I won't cause you any trouble. If you don't marry me, I'll die. But then in the end, she ends with a flourish. She wrote, I suppose no woman ever before wrote such a letter as this, but I am not ashamed, for I am conscious in the light of reason and true refinement that I am worthy of your respect and tenderness, whatever gross man or vulgar-minded woman might think of me. And that's sort of an agency moment. That's when she stops being needy and develops her own criteria for her own worth. And it's assertion of her own worthiness. And it's the beginning of maturity, where you don't need outside criticism or affirmation to make up your mind about something. You know the value of things. And it doesn't work out with Spencer, but it works out with a guy named George Lewes. Lewes is also a writer, a little older than her, and he is legally married. But his wife is, they've estranged, his wife has moved in with another guy and has already born three children with him. But legally, Lewes is married. And in the Victorian world, to be with Lewes is to be an adulteress. And it is to basically write yourself out of society. And so she has to make a decision, do I go with this guy I love, George Lewes, or do I go with everybody else? She thinks about it for a week. She barely consults anybody. She chooses Luz. She writes, "I have counted the cost to the step that I have taken and am prepared to bear without irritation or bitterness, renunciation by all my friends. I am not mistaken in the person to whom I have attached myself. He is worthy of the sacrifice I have incurred, and my only anxiety is that he be rightly judged." They go off to Europe. All hell breaks loose in London. Her family cuts her off. Her friends cut her off. She's the scandal of the age. And yet she'd made a choice for love. And we, of the people we consider deep, all of them would have experienced a great love. It's hard to imagine we'd say someone was great character and had depth if they weren't capable of great love. And for Elliot, like the rest of us, first thing love does is humbles you. It reminds you you're not in control of your own brain. You can't control. You start thinking about your beloved. Love's like an invading army you want to be conquered by. The second thing love does is it opens up hard ground and exposes vulnerable flesh and makes you more amenable or accessible to pain, suffering. The third thing love does, it decenters the self. It reminds you your riches are not in yourself, they're in another person. The fourth thing it does is it fuses you with another, so it eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving. Montaigne has an essay where he says that when you give your friend or your beloved a gift, or when you get more pleasure than the person receiving the gift, because yourselves are fused. And so these are the things that shaped her. But these are the parts of romantic love, idealistic love, poetic love that Taylor Swift sings about. She was by this time a little older, and she'd been bruised by life, and she was knowledgeable about life. And so the love she has is what the philosopher Roger Scruton calls a second love. And that's the kind of love that comes later in life. And it's after you're more aware of the world, maybe less idealistic about it, you're realistic and you're local. And when you're in love at this stage, you're enmeshed in commitments, and you're not in love with the idea of love, you're committed to this specific flawed person, and you are bringing your flawed self to that relationship. This kind of more realistic and local love was described by a friend of mine, Leon Wieseltier, in A Wedding Toast. This kind of love, he said, is private and it is particular. Its object is the specificity of this man and that woman, the distinctiveness of this spirit and that flesh. This love prefers deep to wide, here to there, the grasp to the reach. When the day is done and the lights are out, there is only this other heart, this other mind, this other face to assist in repelling one's demons or in greeting one's angels. It does not matter who the president is. When one consents to marry, one consents to be truly known, which is an ominous prospect. And so one bets on love to correct for the ordinariness of the impression and to call forth the forgiveness that is invariably required. Marriages are exposures. We may be heroes to our spouses, but we may not be idols. So Elliot chose well. She stayed with Luz the rest of her life. They had their troubles. They were depressive personalities, but they were locked together. And about shortly after they got together, Luz said to Elliot, "You know, you should try your hand at fiction," something she had never done. And so she wrote a short story in a week. She came back and read it aloud to him, and he was awash in tears. He knew immediately the talent she had. And in some ways, his love is the superior, because he subordinated his career for the rest of his life to hers, became her agent, her editor, her publicist. She was very sensitive to criticism, so he'd get up early in the morning, and if there were any articles in the newspaper that mentioned her, he would cut them out so she wouldn't have to see them. And the strength of their bond was captured in the inscriptions to her novels that she wrote to him, that she wrote, and she would inscribe each to him. Adam Bede in 1859, "To my dear husband, George Henry Luce, I give the manuscript of a work which would never have been written, but for the happiness which his love has conferred upon my life." Felix Holt in 1866, "From George Eliot to her dear husband, this 13th year of their united life, in which the deepening sense of her own imperfectness has the consolation of their deepening love." Middlemarch in 1872, "To my dear husband, George Henry Luce, in the 19th year of our blessed union." And so these are all experiences and people we can learn from, sort of exemplars, experiences of self-defeat, of being humbled by love, humbled by suffering, finding a vocation larger than self. And it seems to me what they teach in total is two things. First, a phase shift in how we think. We do, as I said before, live in this culture, the big me, where we celebrate ourselves. But the people who have these great moral educations have a different philosophy, an older philosophy that's been forgotten, that begins with Moses, the meekest man on earth. And it's a philosophy that says, first, we don't live for happiness. We're endowed by moral imaginations. We long for holiness. We'd rather lead righteous lives that involve suffering than just happy lives. We're just endowed by this moral nature. Second, we're not wonderful inside. We're divided creatures, both deeply broken and splendidly endowed. Third, the internal struggle against our own weakness, that confrontation with weakness, is the central drama of life, not the external climb to success. Fourth, in this struggle, humility is the greatest virtue. Humility is radical honesty about yourself. It's knowing you're an underdog in the struggle against your weakness. Fifth, pride is the largest vice, because pride blinds you to your own true nature. Character is built over the confrontation with yourself. No person can achieve self-mastery on his or her own. We all need redemptive assistance from outside, from friends, from family, from our heroes, from God. And so it requires a sort of an intellectual phase shift. We grow up in a culture that allows us to think well of ourselves, but it's a little humbling to think accurately of ourselves. Second, we grew up in a very individualistic culture where we think character is something inside, like this little iron power of willpower, like a little Victorian guy in there exercising self-control. But since none of us can really confront our weaknesses on our own, we all need help. Character is really the ability to make commitments. In the realm of intellect, a person of character has, like Johnson, has firm convictions about fundamental things. In the realm of emotion, she is embedded and enmeshed in unconditional loves. In the realm of action, she's committed to causes that cannot be completed in a single lifetime, like Perkins. And so it's the ability to make commitments and not be alone. And then the second thing, aside from the big philosophical shift, there are certain activities that the people I found tended to do. They would isolate their core weakness, their core sin, if you want to use that word. And they would think, how does that sin lead to behavior I'm not proud of? How did I do today? I have a friend, a living friend, whose weakness is hardness of heart. He is not always present for people when they're talking to him. And so he sits at night in bed thinking, well, did that happen to me today? How can I do better tomorrow? The people in this book were really good at admiration, at finding heroes. They were reasonably good, and Johnson especially, and Perkins too, of finding friends with whom they could have discussion circles about these most important things, these eulogy sort of virtues. They found galleries of the dead. I was in Monticello 2 weeks ago, and Johnson surrounded himself with pictures of dead heroes, philosophers, scientists, statesmen. And so he lived with them. And I found in the course of writing this book, I live with the people I've described to you, the Perkinses, the Johnsons, and they're like dead friends, a posse of dead people who set a standard, who you can sort of have conversation with, who you can sort of be inspired by. Now, reading a book doesn't get you there, but these people help provide us with a roadmap. And at least they shift the conversation, shift attention a little toward this moral realm and away from the normal stuff that we live with every day. And the good news is that, you know, it's a communal thing. And so the people who are really involved, most morally alive in their lives, they're doing it with other people, so it's not, like, hard, and it's not joyless. And you find in each of the lives I researched moments of real joy and tranquility. Adam 1, the external Adam, you know, those ambitions are never satisfied. There's always something out there. But Adam 2 does really experience moments of tranquility and radiates joy. The final person I'll mention is Augustine, St. Augustine. He was born in 354 in Africa, and he had a mom named Monica, who was the helicopter mom to beat all helicopter moms. She told him what to believe. She wanted to be with him all the time. She told him who to marry. He was sort of common law marriage with a woman Monica didn't like. She got rid of that woman, got another woman. She was chasing him around, just wanted to control him. He tried to escape, so he left Africa to go to Italy. She's on the shore as his boat is leaving, screaming at him. She takes the next boat over, tracks him down. And so they spend their life in conflict. He knows she loves him, but he knows her love is voracious for him and controlling. Finally, he has his famous conversion. He becomes the sort of Catholic she wants. He becomes the sort of man she wants. And by this time, she's about 56, and he's in his 30s. She says to him, you know, all my life I wanted you to be a certain sort of person. And now you are. And I thought I wanted to go back to Africa to die. It's my homeland. But I figured God's everywhere. I can die anywhere. I can die here. I'm fine. My work here is basically done. And so she tells him this, and in fact, 9 days later, she does die. And they have a conversation which he describes, or their final real conversation. And it's in a garden. And after all the years of conflict, they merge sweetly together. He said they had a harmony in their conversation. They were thinking about their lives. They were projecting forward into the next life. Their conversation, quote, did by degrees pass through all things bodily, even the very heaven, when the sun and the moon and stars shine upon the earth. We came to our own minds and went beyond them into the realm of pure spirit. And then he has a long sentence, which is actually very hard to parse. It's very complicated. I can't really understand it. But he has one word that is repeated throughout the sentence, and that word is hushed. And so he said, you know, the sound of the trees was hushed. The sound of the birds was hushed. The sound of our voices was hushed. The sound of our heartbeats was hushed. The sound of our movements was hushed. The sound of the air was hushed. And you get this sense of just beautiful tranquility. And that's when Adam 1 bows down to Adam 2. And I think that's part of the joy that you see in the ladies in Frederick or the Dalai Lama. It doesn't last forever. And maybe it's even what I experienced in the lawn looking at my kids. When ambition dies down, and Adam, too, is just fulfilled for a minute. And that's the pleasure that comes at the end of this process. Thanks very much.